Are you looking for a space to express yourself and tell your story? If so, Cafe Cultura is here for you, whether through our open mic events every second Friday or our spoken word workshops every third Friday. Here is a taste of what we do at 910 Gallo Pago Street.
You say my white smile is a disorder, my deep laughs are a sickness, and the connection I have with my dad isn't real. And I know that when I'm up, I'm up, and when I'm down, but it's these ups that keep me from being down, and if you took away these ebbs and flows, I'd be a flat line. I don't want to be sick anymore, a slave to these pills, a puppet on antipsychotic strings, one to laugh, one to sleep, one to dream, and one to numb the pain of their tight grips on my wrists, cutting off the blood flow and turning my hands blue. I am blue, but that is only, I am blue, but I cried the day I found out that meant sad. I am blue, but I didn't know it until you told me I am blue. And when I try to show the colors of my rainbow, you strip me back to just one hue. I am blue. But I don't want to be sick anymore.
You can be what you are, and I'll accept you for who you are. And although I wish you'd do the same for me, I'm not here to judge, and I know that you love me still. I love you for you. You bore me, you fed me. You're the best advice I've ever had. I just wish you would embrace that part of me, Mom, because she's wonderful. She's sweet. She makes me happy, and I wish you could see, but that's okay, Mom. I'll defend you. I don't want you to go away. I want you to stay with me. And one day, when your eyes close, I know that you'll know that I loved you for you and that I defended your point of view because you don't have to like every part of me and because I admire you for you.
Ideas all seem pre-created, but does that mean new ideas are going to be hated? The thinking process of an idea starts off small, but it's like an infant and stumbles and falls. But where do ideas go when inspiration calls? What direction can make you speak with conviction? Here I am still hung up on this last election. It sits in this country's heart like a bad infection. We say, I did not choose to move in this alt-right direction. I wish I could remember a time where an idea wasn't a Google search away, a time where I wasn't given the exact play-by-play day-to-day. We stand together and say, whose line is it anyway?
The words. They're dancing, they're spinning, they touch my cheek, they hold my hand, they brush across my lips as I repeat them after her. But it's not the same. When words come out of her mouth, it's as beautiful and natural as the breeze blowing through the trees. You can't see it, but you can feel it. It touches every part of your body, and when you inhale it, it sends shivers through your body. Only it's her words. Each letter precisely placed next to one another to create a word, a sentence, a thought, a story that consumes you for as long as her breath lasts, and then she inhales. Once again, the letters grow and multiply, painting pictures on the canvas of my mind. With each word, there's a stroke of color. At first, you can't decipher who or what it is. You can only feel it. No real pattern, no rhythm, no outline of what it could be. Then she takes another breath. You blink, and there it is, in its entirety. The feelings you can never put into words, but they're her words to someone else.
Dear white people, welcome to the land of the brave and the free. I live in a country born on genocide and built on the backs of slaves. Dear white people, el fútbol no es my favorite sport, y mi cultura is not as exotic as you call it. Gringo, no soy Hispanic, no soy Latina. Soy Chicana, indígena, mexicana, brown.
I was born with the terms and conditions box already checked, regardless if I agreed with them or not. It's in my blood. It is embedded so deep in me that a switch would be useless. I cannot turn off the fact that indigenous women are more likely to be sexually assaulted than any other race, and I cannot simply turn off the fact that my people are living in poverty, and I cannot simply turn off the fact that my people are dying. The reason I am so vocal about these issues, the ones that interfere with which way your switch is flipped, is because it's my cry for help. It's my way for you to try and listen, to try and see the pain that accompanies not being able to turn it off. So please, next time you tell me just to get over it, see past your switch and notice that I don't have one.
You've just heard some powerful words from Cafe Cultura's last event. If you'd like to hear more, then join us February 9th at 7 p.m. at 910 Gallo Pago Street for our monthly open mic event featuring Face the MC, Lady Speech Sankofa, the Sing Our Rivers Red Traveling Earring Exhibit, and community feature Street Fraternity. There, you can experience and contribute to the creativity of your community. For more details, visit us online at cafecultura.org and all social media platforms.
Happy Black History Month, everyone. This is Dave Ashton in the KGNU Denver studio, and I'm joined by one of the participants in the hashtag 28 Days Is Not Enough movement. Also, really incredible writer and illustrator, Joel Christian Gill. Welcome back to KGNU.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate being here.
Yes, sir. You are here in Denver in support of your new book, Strange Fruit, Volume 2, More Uncelebrated Narratives from Black History.
That's correct.
Tell us how you got started being an illustrator and writer.
Mostly because my own stories were failing. So I did a series of paintings that were based on Billie Holiday's song, Strange Fruit.
Mm.
And those paintings were, I had a show and a friend of mine came to the show and he looked at the paintings and he said, your paintings seem like they're trying to tell stories and they're failing. And so I said, well, you know, maybe I should go back to thinking about how to use comics as a medium. And then I started trying to tell my own story with comics, which was failing dramatically. And so I then ran across the story for Henry Box Brown, who was a slave who mailed himself in a box from Virginia to Philadelphia. And at the same time, I was cyber stalking, you know, the cartoonist Box Brown, who did Andre the Giant. When I ran across his name, I was just like, why is he named after this slave? And so I sent him a message and I said, you know, why are you named after a slave when you're this white kid in Philadelphia? And he's like, well, I'm square shaped, so my friends call me Box, but I think I might do a story about that guy sometime. And I was like, that's a fantastic idea. I'm going to steal your idea. And so I did that story. You know, the funny thing about it is when you do stories and you go out and you sell comics, people start telling you more stories. And so people started telling me more and more stories. And as they told me more and more stories, I ended up getting more stories for more books. And so over the course of a couple of years, I had a plethora of stories and then I put them together as Strange Fruit. I mean, the stories just kept coming. So I have a backlog of stories to tell. So
last time you were on KGNU, we were talking about the Western gunmen. Bass Reeves.
Yeah, Bass Reeves was the most successful U.S. Marshal in American history, and his story is so closely aligned to the Lone Ranger. A lot of people think he may have been the inspiration for the Lone Ranger. You know, he would go out into this panhandle, which was called No Man's Land at the time, or the Dead Zone. He would go out there by himself with like a Native American sidekick, and to do investigative work, he would dress in disguises. And when he left a place after clearing up the criminals in that place, he would leave behind a silver dollar as a token that he had been there. His story is the Lone Ranger's story. Whether he is actually the inspiration is up for grabs. I believe he might be the inspiration for the Lone Ranger. So
that's incredible. So how many books, comics, graphic novels have you put out?
I've put out four. I've been in a couple of anthologies, but I've been in four books that I've created myself.
So Strange Fruit Volume 2 is a collection of eight stories.
There are eight stories in there from a wide range of time periods. There's no real modern stories. I mean, I guess Eugene Bullard's story, which is one of my favorites, it's the longest story in Strange Fruit Volume 2, is about the first African-American fighter pilot. And he fought for the French in World War I. And he left and he goes and he has this amazing life. He wins the French Legion of Honor. When you go to Paris and you look in, you know, they have a museum for the Legion of Honor winners. There's like an exhibit of him in there. He fought in the French Resistance. He was a spy. He spoke a number of languages. He was friends with Josephine Baker, Langston Hughes. Ernest Hemingway actually wrote about him in one of his books. And he comes back to the United States in the 1950s after fleeing the war, and he becomes an elevator operator. He doesn't actually get acknowledged in the United States until 1993.
That's incredible. Eugene Bullard, not a name that people are probably very familiar with.
I know. And if he was a white guy, we would probably have four movies about him already.
No doubt. And actually predated the Tuskegee Airmen.
He predated Tuskegee Airmen, exactly. He had one unconfirmed kill, but he flew with a regiment called, I can't pronounce it in French, but the regiment was called All Blood Runs Red.
Which is pretty revolutionary statement. You know, people have a lot of ideas about the amount of melanin a person possesses.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I spend most of the time talking about is how the concept of race in America was like invented in the late 1700s, early 1800s by a man named Nathaniel Bacon. Not invented by him, but he was the cause of it. But there's this thing called the Bacon's Rebellion. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but Bacon decided to unite the black slaves and the white indentured servants all together to create a army that would take over the Virginia government, and he almost succeeded. And because he almost succeeded, they had to figure out this way to keep these poor black people and poor white people separate. And so they did away with indentured servitude, and they made only chattel slavery for blacks. And then they gave the white people, the poor whites, like one step up on the socioeconomic ladder, and gave them some of the first law enforcement jobs in America, which were slave catchers. That separated the poor black people and the poor white people till, you know, it's still separated. We're still separated now. So I think that people have a tendency to not realize how close we are, because race was invented, and it was invented because of the wealthiest 1% of people wanted to separate these people, to keep them separate. And that still happens now, but it was more blatant at that time. And ultimately, it keeps us looking more at how we're different as opposed to how, I mean, the difference between, you know, quote unquote, races of people is like a rounding error in genetics. It's not even, it's such a minuscule amount of difference that creates all the variations in us that I don't think people realize, just like, it has no bearing on, you know, who we are as people.
There's no way to tell, genetically speaking, if somebody would be termed a black person, a Latino person, a white person.
No, you can tell genetically, but the thing you have to look at is such a small amount. It's such a small, it's so small to be insignificant. You know what I mean? It's kind of like going into, a library of thousands of books, and there's two books in there that are, about, red shoes. And you go, well, those red shoes books are the biggest problem we have. Like, it's so small, so insignificant that it's not even worth talking about.
But here we are in Black History Month, and, concerted effort must be made to bring the history of the African American.
Absolutely. Forward. And I think, with 28 Days Are Not Enough, which I started with my first book, Strange Fruit, Volume 1, is this understanding that Carter G. Woodson created Black History Week, which is what it was. It was to celebrate Frederick Douglass's birthday and Lincoln's birthday. It was 1920s, because he said that a people that doesn't know their history are lost. It gradually increased to 2 weeks. And then Nixon, with the help of a Black Student Union, I think at Kent State, expanded it to a month. But the problem is that that's one of those things where the path to hell is paved with good intentions, right?
Right.
It's like, we're trying to do this really good thing and show black people and give black people their due. But what we've done is inadvertently made it okay to put black history in a box and set it on a shelf and not look at it until it's Black History Month. And it's like, oh, now is the time we should talk about that. That's when we should be explaining these things to people. When in reality, those stories are more quintessentially American stories than they are any ethnic group. Do you know what I mean? They're like, yes. This is like, it's like one of the things that I think is like one of the most striking insults that black people get is to go back to Africa. And this is probably from somebody whose family came here in the 1920s. Do you know what I mean? Like,
sure.
My family's been here since Jamestown, right? Like, you go to Washington, D.C., and the thing that strikes you, it should strike you as a person, is that slaves built, like literally built, the nation's capital.
Right.
And people are saying, well, you're not part of American. And it feels like by incorporating these stories and people thinking about these stories, it will get the understanding that, hip hop and baggy pants are just as American as cowboy boots and country music. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And I think that when we start looking at how we are, like, we start looking at where we are like, then we can forget about those differences because they're so small and insignificant.
I think the stories that you've chosen to highlight in the second volume of Strange Fruit really point that out. In particular, say Cathay Williams.
Yeah, Cathay Williams is the first and only known female Buffalo soldier who fought in the Union Army. And the only reason why we know that is because she applied for benefits. And when she applied for benefits, she was denied for no reason. It was just denied. They didn't say you're denied for any reason.
Mm.
Like, there's this woman who fights in the Union Army, and there's another woman who actually gets benefits, and she's white, but Cathay Williams gets denied.
And so a Buffalo soldier, for folks unfamiliar with that term, would be black soldiers fighting on the side of the Union in the Civil War.
Yeah, it was Native Americans who gave black soldiers the name Buffalo soldiers because of their hair, their skin color, and their ferociousness in battle.
Uh-huh. It's a sad tale because she ultimately really dies in poverty.
And obscurity, yes.
And obscurity. Others, like the blind virtuoso musician Tom Wiggins.
Tom Wiggins is probably, you know, like my favorite drawn story in Strange Fruit is the story of Eugene Boulard. My favorite actual story is the story of Blind Tom Wiggins because it's this slave who is an autistic savant. And when they find out he's an autistic savant, he can like mimic any kind of sounds, any kind of, he can do any of this stuff. And they put him on display. They send him out and he travels for the Confederacy, raising money for the Confederacy because he can play any kind of music. They would have these like battles where they would bring up a professor of music from the town that they were in, from the university, and have him play something and see if Tom could play that. And after hearing it one time, he would play these things. And when his master died and after he was freed, there was this draconian contract he was put under that his family was paid like a minuscule amount of money. And he does that for a number of years, and there's a court battle. And when the court battle comes out, he is billed as the last American slave because his contract was so draconian. I mean, he ends up, you know, living out his days with family, his master's former daughter-in-law's family and his mother, and he dies in the early 1900s.
Sort of. Perhaps, I hate to say it, a foreshadowing of what might happen in the music industry, where Frankie Lyman signs away Earth Angel for a hot dog lunch.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, it is a foreshadowing for what happens to black performers or all performers in the early part of the 20th century. So until, you know, you get people like, you know, Jay-Z, for example, who's like, you know, I don't sign on a record label. I am a record label, and sort of take agency of their own work. And it takes a long time. It's really quite amazing. I remember reading an article, just to sort of digress, that was Outkast, and it was after their first album. They were like, we made like $30,000 off that first record.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, you see me on television. It's not like I'm rich. It's like, you just see me on television.
Folks, we are speaking with Joel Christian Gill, the author and illustrator of the graphic novel Strange Fruit, Volume 2, just fresh out, a 2018 release date on it. This is immaculately researched. You have great footnotes in here. You're not going on hearsay with these historic figures.
Yeah, and I try to find firsthand, you know, one of the things about history I think that most people have a tendency to misunderstand is that it's not ever black or white. You know what I mean? It's not like it's either this or that. It's often, more often than not, gray. Like the, you know, people were good and bad. You know what I mean? Like it wasn't really pure and noble. And so to that regard, I try not to look at what people have written about these people, like after the fact. I try to find stuff that was firsthand information. Mm. For example, with the story of Millie and Christine McCoy, who were billed as the two-headed nightingale, or the Carolina twins, they were conjoined twins. They actually wrote a pamphlet that actually they wrote or dictated to someone else about their lives. And one of the things that is interesting about them is that they prefer to be called one person as opposed to being called individual. And so what we would default to now is like they're two individual people, but those, they really wanted to be called one person. Their epitaph on their grave headstone says something like two hearts beating as one. Do you know what I mean?
Like so, one soul.
It's one soul, yeah. You know, so like that's the area, right, where it's like gray, right? It's like, you know, we would default as in modern times of thinking of them as two different people and wanting to use our sensibilities about them. But if I use their own words, then it's them talking as I.
Yes. You know, it's interesting that modern times, how we live in this day and age, really precludes a lot of the experiences that are in this story, or this series of stories, that is. For example, Willie Kennard pops up, and he has a portion of his life documented where he is the sheriff of a small town in Colorado.
Yeah. Yankee Hill, Colorado, which no longer exists. It's like an unregistered area. And he shows up and they're like, the townspeople put up these signs, and the signs were, you know, looking for a sheriff because they had outlaws that were terrorizing the town. And so they were like, they were looking for a sheriff, and he shows up. And, you know, some information I found has him working in the military as a sergeant at arms or in an armory. And that when he left Yankee Hill, Colorado, he became the bodyguard of Barney Ford, who was the Baron of Colorado.
Okay.
But I can't find any real connection to those things. But just a couple of newspaper articles about Willie Kennard, you know, coming and saving this town and then just like vanishing into thin air again. It's a really dope story. Like just hearing about like this former slave slash union officer who like shows up into town and basically does something that's like, it's literally the Old West story, right? The stranger drifts into town and saves the town.
Yeah. It's the archetype.
Yeah. It's the archetype, which is interesting because the archetype of, you know, the Outlaw Josie Wales, I think it was the Outlaw Josie Wales or, one of those movies were written by a Klansman. And a lot of those movies were like written about like, you know, these Confederate soldiers who were going out west because they couldn't deal with the Yankees, you know what I mean, like in the South.
And, interesting.
But in reality, only one in every three people were white in the Old West because it were Native American and Black. And so like one in every only one white guy in every, you know, in every third, you know, it was like a third of them were white. But when you watch those things on television, it's like they're all white. There's no Black people. There are no Native Americans.
Right. When, and they're sort of holding those people at bay.
Yeah. So not realizing that this was a place for people to find a new way. Like the West was really a barren wasteland, so Black people would flock there too. Like, and most people, like one of the most amazing facts I found when researching the stories is that in Oklahoma after 1877, there were 150,000 Black people in Oklahoma who fled there, and then there was a couple of hundred like all Black towns, which is like an amazing thing.
Indeed.
We don't talk about that.
We don't. And you know, it's like, well, we're sort of ahistorical, I would say, as a society. And honestly, if a movie comes along that gives a cool little story on it, people be like, okay, that's what happened.
Like, we get this idea that, you know, this is the thing. It's like, we don't want the truth. We want to be lied to. And I think the thing that most people don't understand about just representation and how these stories sort of change the narrative, like things like Black Panther about to come out and how it changed the narrative, like Black people are fighting an uphill battle against media representation. Like, we've been represented in the media at negatively for over 100, you know, almost 200 years.
Right.
And you look at, you know, the famous slave from Birth of a Nation who basically set the standard for shifty, you know, evil Black men. I forget his name. I want to say it was like Ned or something like that. But, you know, like that sets the standard. And like, you got all this like years of negative, negative representation of Black people. And so if you think about like as a deposit in a, like a relationship, if Black people have a relationship with America and their deposits, you put positive deposits and negative deposits. Black people have deposited, you know, sports stars and music and culture. And, you know, hip hop is the most, you know, the most popular music in America. We've like contributed so much.
Language, fashion,
like we've contributed so much, but the, you know, the balance for us is negative. You know, we're still negative. Like, it used to be negative $500. Now we're about negative $250, $300. Mm. You know what I mean? So we're still moving in a positive direction. So what people don't understand is that, you know, while, you know, having an all Black this thing or all Black that thing may seem exclusive, but it's actually trying to make up for, you know, hundreds of years of poor representation in the media for what Black people are supposed to be.
You know, that actually reminds me of another great anecdote in your book about the Green Book, you know, and leading people on the road. This was a traveler's guide,
right,
that helped African Americans to navigate and stay safe with their families when they're in unfamiliar areas, just to get basic services.
Yeah, and I think one of the thing about like the civil rights movement and the things that happened before, you know, the early part of the 20th century is that a lot of those people are still alive. Like, my mom remembers drinking from a colored water fountain in the South. And I think people think of it as being something that happened back then.
The black and white times.
Yeah, like before color television. And not realizing that, you know, when Black people left the South en masse in the 1920s and 30s, you know, we call it, you know, it's called the Great Migration. But in reality, it was like Black refugees. You know, it was like we were being, you know, misplaced because of white terrorism. You know, and when people started coming back in the invention of the automobile, when the automobile becomes big and popular for everybody, we can now come back to the South. But now we're like almost a generation removed. So who do we go? Like, how do we get there? And so Victor Green created this book that would document places where you could go. Because I don't think people realize that if you were Black in 1950 and you drove south from, like, let's just say you were living in Boston, you drove south, you would hit places called sundown towns, which, like in New Jersey, you know, not in the Deep South, which meant that Black people couldn't be out after night. Or you would get to a place where they wouldn't serve what you couldn't get gas. You could run out of gas on the side of the road because there were a place that wouldn't serve you because you were black. And like, so, you know, we've come a long way because that's not there anymore. But what we have now is even a little more insidious. You know, it's not as out in the open. So you can't really point at it. I mean, now it's out in the open, but it used to be that it wasn't out in the open is you couldn't point at it. But now we can actually point at it and look at it and say, yeah, that's what it looks like. That's what the racism looked like. It's telling me that I am not American when my family has been here since Jamestown and your family came here in the 1920s in Ellis Island. Like you have a generation removed and nobody has an accent anymore and you eat, you know, hamburgers just like everybody else, but I'm the one that's not American when my family has been here since, you know, for 400 years and built this nation.
Well, it seems like on a level there's, you know, it's just about the green for a lot of folks when it comes to that. You're not going to find people not selling you gasoline because they're going to want your money from you.
Right. And that's, you know, that documentation of how people understand that black people care about stuff is common, right? It happens during the blaxploitation movement when they say, oh, black people will go to the movies when Sweetback's, you know, the movie. I don't
Melvin
know if I can
Van
say
Peoples,
Melvin Van Peoples
Sweet,
movie.
Sweetback's badass.
Yeah,
song.
I wasn't sure if I could say it. And that movie, he like borrowed money for like $10,000 and he makes this movie and it makes like a couple of $100,000. And they're like, oh my God, black people like movies. Let's make movies. And so they start making all of these movies for black people. And it just like that happens, you know, it happens with hip hop. It happens with a number of things. And so I think money drives it, but they'll take the money, but you don't want to take the influence. I think there's a friend of mine was just telling me that there's a statistic that, you know, most people like diversity, but only up to about 6%. As soon as it hits 6%, people start to leave.
Interesting.
Yeah. So like it gets to a place where it's like 6% and then they start to leave. And it's just like, this is the problem. We're not looking at how we're all the same. You know, like I often say all the time is that we no longer have empathy. We no longer know what it's like to be somebody else. We look at people and we don't say, I can understand what that's like. You know, I can understand what it's like to be a black man and going into an elevator with a bunch of white people and feeling like I have to make myself look less intimidating. You know, like what kind of, and it seems like a silly thing, but like what kind of oppression that sort of idea is. And yeah, I can't ignore it, but I live in a society that's told, like people say you should not don't think about it. We don't talk about race. Like I cannot talk about race all day, every day, but apparently eventually America will remind me, you know what I mean? And so like I need people, and this is like my call to action with 28 Days Are Not Enough, is that I need people to like embrace the idea that black history is American history, because when we share these stories, we share bits and pieces of ourselves. When we have a conversation with someone, you share bits and pieces of yourself. And if I can share, this is my way of sharing bits and pieces of the black community with everyone else.
Listeners, we're speaking with Joel Christian Gill, the author and illustrator of Strange Fruit, Volume 2, More Uncelebrated Narratives from Black History. You know, within the Green Book, there was a place called Idlewild. You mentioned Outkast a few minutes ago. Most people would just know Idlewild as an Outkast vehicle movie. But what was Idlewild?
Idlewild was the premier black place to go up until the 1960s. It was a resort that, you know, I think one of the things that it was a place where black people could check race at the door. And I think that's the thing that people don't understand about why black people have a tendency to do an all black this or an all black that. Because at that point, when you know, I have a friend, John Jennings, who puts on these black comic book arts festivals all over the country. And it's not like white people aren't, you know, welcome to come. But it's like he wants to put these things on so that when people come there, you know, you can like, you don't have to think about whether there's a black character or representation. You know there's going to be there. So like you can check race at the door. And Idlewild was a place like that where black people could go during segregation because you couldn't go everywhere. You couldn't go to major theme, not Disney or like because Disney didn't exist at that point, but other major theme parks. You couldn't go to public pools. Like I grew up in a town where black people weren't allowed in a public pool until the 1980s.
Wow.
And so you get these little places. Like Idlewild, and there's a couple of other ones as well, Oak Bluffs and in Martha's Vineyard. There's a number of different places where black people could go and not have to worry about, you know, people like harassing them because they want to go swimming. You know, they want their kids to play on the beach. They didn't have to worry about, you know, like being careful. You know, like now it's a place to just kind of like breathe. You know, it's like, it's like the way I like to think about this is like having to have really tight boots on because it's snowy outside and having to take those off, and that feeling when you finally take off those boots and how it like feels really good. You can stretch.
You
your feet
just
out.
Natural.
Yeah, you're just like, you take your feet, you take your shoes off, and that's what it was like for black people to go to Idlewild and stay at a place, because now they could just like, they could breathe. Like, you weren't always worried about something happening.
Joel Christian Gill, this is really a tremendous book. I recommend people, you know, check this out. Where can they get a little view of this online?
You can hit me up on at JCG007 on Twitter, or Joel Christian Gill at anything, Facebook. My Instagram, I have a lot of process work on Instagram, or you can pick it up at local bookstores, independent bookstores. You can get it from fulcrumbooks.com. And of course, there's that big one that you can get that I won't advertise on here that everybody knows about, but I won't say their name.
Gotcha.